Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Welcome back, everybody, and apologies from my side. It was an idiotic communication from my side that caused my guest to not return as speedily as he normally does. I'm taking full responsibility, unlike some people we know, for what has happened. I'm doing something unusual this week. We're having Terence Corrigan on to talk further about EWC, and I think it's the first time I've ever done a sort of back-to-back, let's call it EWC the sequel, and I think we might have a Star Wars series in the making, or maybe even more explosive than that. Terence, welcome back to Chai FM, and perhaps I can start, because of course between then and now we didn't know what would happen. Just your comment on President Trump's rather, shall we say, unhelpful intervention in promising refuge to beleaguered South Africans allegedly harmed or to be harmed by the EWC, expropriation without compensation.
Hi, Cyrus. Sorry about the confusion with the time. I think that one has to be careful in interpreting that, because I believe that Trump has his own agenda, which I think, you know, in which South Africa I think is very tangential. My concern about it, and I said this in my column on Monday, is that this is more helpful to the pro EWC forces, because Trump, being a very divisive figure, he kind of became the story. Very few things seem to animate our deep thinkers than, well, anything Trump seems to say. And it, you know, I ruefully conclude that Trump derangement syndrome is a thing. So if Trump says something, we must do the opposite. That's kind of what Joseph Stalin did at the beginning of World War II, when he was warned that the Germans were actually going to be knocking on his door. If the British and Americans say it, we must do the opposite. Well, that didn't work out so well. Point is, though, that it's a damaging statute. I think my own sense is that is that expropriation, land, whatever, is just a part of Trump's mix, and not necessarily, and I don't think the most important part. And I think the whole refugee thing, there's so much water that would have to go under the bridge for that to be action, that it's almost a sort of throwaway. Let's say it's performative.
Can I just say, I think that's exactly right. That's how I describe much of Trump's initial comments on anything. It's theatre. It is performative.
And absolutely,
while they are sometimes embarrassing and certainly not helpful to us, because of course the race grifters get into action and sort of soil the public discourse. But it's become quite apparent that is how Trump works. He comes in with the ridiculous, and things change. I mean, already people are trying to explain to South Africa that, you know, that's really not the refugee thing is really not the gist of the matter. But our commentators seem to think, you know, they do exactly that. They react to the man because they hate him, but they just don't sort of look a little more, shall we say, carefully and with a little bit of more skepticism that these things deserve.
Look, you know, I think that to understand this, understand that South Africa has been poking America in the eye for 20 years. Now, under Thabo Mbeki, they can sort of get away with it because he was, I think, a diplomat by disposition, and he disposed of a rather more competent state system. Although I was also told by one diplomatic insider that he had given explicit instructions to one ambassador to Washington to downgrade the relationship. And they did things like refuse to allow staff to interact with congressional aides, and, you know, will basically do what diplomats are supposed to do. But, you know, then he tried to row back from that because he discovered that it wasn't such a great idea to, you know, damage goodwill that you have. But, you know, under Obama, Under Biden, those relationships have been frayed. And you know, if you look at that executive order, there's an interesting thing at the bottom which Franz Krenia drew attention to about South Africa's relationship with Iran and assisting them with I forget the exact wording, but basically the implication seems to be helping them with arms production. And I think that probably gets a lot closer to America's concern.
Mm.
But I think for various emotional reasons, previous administrations have been quite indulgent. And I think Trump is singularly unsentimental.
Mm. No, yes.
I think if you look at it, he went after Canada and Denmark, which are sort of close American allies.
Mm.
But, you know, he pressed particular pain points.
Yeah.
You know, Canada's should be our next state. Like Canadians define themselves as not being Americans. So, you know, that was something that really shook them up. Denmark, you know, reminding them, well, you know, this is a sort of colonial arrangement you have here, you know, the nice progressive postmodern Danes. And can you really protect it? Mm. And, you know, what are you going to do when the Chinese fleet sails over, you know, across the Arctic?
Mm.
You know, those are, I may not endorse the way he does business, but in those cases, I think it was fairly effective.
So shouldn't as some of our diplomats did do, is with Trump, you've probably best got to just note something he said and perhaps express a little concern and hope that, you know, the relationship will be reset and everything will be done to do, you know, to achieve that, and leave it at that and wait to see what actually happens.
Yeah, look, I'm afraid that option probably isn't open to us, because there is a huge amount on the table. So you do want to try and mend fences.
Yeah.
My concern really is that so much of what has animated the South African side of the relationship is ideological and geopolitical, in the sense that South Africa is a sort of revolutionary power and it's marching in lockstep with China, you know, to overthrow the American order, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Which, you know, if a sovereign state, you've got your good right to do that. But it's just that South Africa is not a credible country to get involved, you know, to take on that mantle. China is the world's second biggest economy.
Mm.
You know, it has it's a big player. South Africa just isn't.
Mm.
And its economic eggs are very much in the basket of the part of the world that it seems to despise. Mm. So it just seems to me this is not geared to ending well.
Yeah. Well, let's, on that note, let's go back to the expropriation with our conversation, the Expropriation Act. And last week we discussed much of the substance of it, but I'd like to look at some of the sort of practical implications. And mm-hmm. we drew up a set of FAQs on expropriation that are on the RR website,
right,
which people can access and get a very nice take on the issue broadly. So let me just start with asking one of those questions, and that is that if an expropriating authority decides to expropriate me, how will I find out?
Well, you'll get a notice of expropriation. And then, you know, you sort of get to negotiate. What will then sort of happen is that they will, although they'll send you a notice of intention to expropriate, then a notice of expropriation. The notice of expropriation then gives you the date on which, you know, basically you've got to be out of there.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no real limit to what they can demand. So maybe it's the next day. Now, you know, I'm talking. I think here we're talking very much about fixed property. I'm not sure how this would play out if they decided, for instance, to go up to 10% of, you know, the country's savings
and
what. But presumably, it would be something similar. I suppose you could serve a notice on your place of business, for instance. So yeah, you know, that's a And what can then happen is, you know, if you dispute it, you can go. It's meant to be mediated, because in South Africa we believe everything can be mediated and negotiated, because we believe we have this enormous capacity for negotiation, although we don't really. And then, you know, if that one doesn't work, you know, you can take it to court. But you know, the fun part here is that the expropriating authority can still sort of take your stuff, and you know, you still end up having to So, you know, for me, if I had to encapsulate the problem, it's not necessarily, you know, foot the bill. You know, the idea that it is possible to come up with a formula that gives you nil compensation, because I do think there could well be issues where this does happen. You think of those derelict abandoned buildings in downtown Joburg, for instance. But it's the sense that the process is skewed against the property holder. You know, also the idea of just and equitable compensation, which is very vague, and you know, it sounds nice, but you know, just like Hansel and Gretel discovered that as nice as the gingerbread house tasted, you know, it was a trap. So, you know, I think you're certainly going to get instances of lowballing. I think that you're quite you may actually in certain instances get quite the opposite. Let me explain. You get a politically connected business person who needs some ready cash, and you know, this vacant lot in a decaying part of town, you know, is all of a sudden urgently needed by the authority, which figures that just and equitable is five times its market value. You know, there's that sort of thing as well, because the standards seem very fungible and not constrained by any particular set of rationality.
Terence, the act refers to expropriating in the public interest, and generally in legislation where expropriation is allowed in other countries, the term used is expropriation. Not interest, but purpose. For the public purpose.
Yes, yes.
What is the difference between the two? Because there's something.
Okay. A public purpose is something that, let's say, benefits the common weal, which is in a sense uncontrovertible. So, building dams, building roadways, that sort of thing. You know, admittedly, the environmentalists would probably dispute that, but you get the point. Now, some years ago, I shared a flat with a lady who had grown up in Stellenbosch, and she said that her parents had twice been evicted from farms they'd lived on because the government decided to build a roadway through, and then they decided off to farm number two. Irrespective of where they built a farm, the government was going to find a reason to build a road through it. So they went and sold real estate after that. The public interest is more nebulous. It's things like land. It's policy goals. So, land reform is the sort of headline example. But you know, you could also think about things like what's already happened: the nationalization of water rights, mineral rights, mineral resources. You know, looking further down the line, you know, we've been promised more aggressive BEE. I wonder whether there isn't an application here. The NHI, there was a suggestion from the head of the Health Professions Council that the government should nationalize all the sort of saving funds and medical aids to capitalize the NHI. Now, I don't know if this. I imagine there'd be a phalanx of lawyers to contest that, but conceptually, I can imagine that you could make that you could make a case. You know, say, well, you know, we are for the public interest of the nation's health, we require 10% of everything that's in held in medical funds, and this will be paid over. And if you want, and you know, the obvious legal vehicle to do it with would be the Expropriation Act.
Right. Terence, we're going to go to an ad break and we'll pick it up after that.
IFM 101.9 megahertz of life.
Terence, just to sum up, essentially the government would have to issue a notice of intention to expropriate, give you 30 days to respond and enter into mediation stroke negotiation. But once the government decides to issue a notice of expropriation itself, it can theoretically happen very quickly. Perhaps these processes have failed.
Yeah.
That is one, for us, one of the problems with the Act, and particularly for individuals, small companies or whatever, is that they are then pushed into a situation where to fight it means going through a court process that is lengthy, costly, and will probably destroy your lives. At the same time, some of the big business associations have come out sort of in defense of the president, saying that there are enough safeguards. There are? Or are the safeguards irrelevant to big business?
Look, it's a okay. This is not a law that allows blanket seizure just because just don't say so. There are steps. There is provision for court oversight. But you know, as I say, the principle is that the process is skewed towards the state. So yes, you can go to court if you can afford it. My sense of the way business businesses approach this, and this is business in general, and also the agricultural sector, is that they are kind of desperate to protect their relationship with the government, and also I think there's the sort of Trump factor that they are very concerned about their market access to the U.S. That's particularly important for agriculture, because agriculture is a big beneficiary of AGOA. And that's also why, when I've spoken to American officials over the years, I've sort of emphasized this, that as critical as I can be of the South African government, be wary of using those sort of things as pressure points, because the people most immediately hit by them are going to be people who are generally fairly favorably disposed to America and are invested in that relationship. And secondly, people who are maybe not particularly concerned about the relationship but are not hostile to America, it doesn't really feature in their lives. But this is the kind of thing that that could produce this rally around the flag effect. That is for me the concern. The other thing, of course, is that there's we've plotted in probably 400 expropriating authorities, many of which are derelict, incapacitated, incompetent local authorities that might see this as a sort of bonanza time. Now, as I'm saying this, there is a case in Heidelberg, and we don't know the full details. And you know, perhaps there's more to it than at first glance. But where somebody leasing a property to, I think it was the health department, and hadn't been paid his rent in years, it was $59,000 a month. So you know, it accumulates. Then they decided, and they served them with a notice of eviction, and then they responded by saying, well, they're expropriating the property now, and they're not going to pay them anything near what they owe. Now, whether or not this is the full story in this case, that is a very plausible scenario that you could find. The sort of cutting the Gordian knot. We're in arrears, for all this money. Well, I'll tell you what, we think just an equitable payment is, 10 cents on the rand, 10 cents on the rand, and we'll just take it now. Of course, it'll probably all fall to rack and ruin because you're not dealing with the most efficient institutions, but yeah, it gets you out of your immediate problem. And the time horizon in which much of officialdom thinks in this country doesn't seem to be more than a few days.
Well, in fact, you answered the question I was about to ask, which is that one mustn't envisage expropriation of being in the hands of national government alone. It's provincial, local, and anyone and everyone.
There are also questions about, you know, whether something like Eskom could expropriate.
Mm.
Let me throw another wrinkle in. Different government departments or levels of government expropriate each other. Hmm. That is not beyond the realm of possibility. Provincial government wanting land for a hospital which belongs to a municipality, for instance.
Hmm.
I think that's sort of eminently possible. But, you know, said local government may, you know, be enthralled to a local, you know, let me say businessman in inverted commas. There's big demands for money being made.
Mm.
Can
I pose, what if an authority wants to expropriate your land?
Yeah.
And you still have a mortgage over the property on the land, or the property, let's call it.
Okay.
Do you have to carry on paying your mortgage? Does the bank pick it up? Does the government pick it up?
Okay.
Who gets the short end?
You do, basically. That's the long and short of it. There is nothing that says that the state is responsible for any sort of outstanding encumbrances on it. Now, I surmise the thinking, they would say, well, we'll pay you what you think, and then from that you must deal with, you know, the outstanding bills and whatever. So if that leads to, you know, so if we give you 10 cents on the rand and you end up with, you know, minus 10 cents on the rand off paid off the bank, well, you know, that's your problem, and you know, we really don't care. Now, I think that the banking industry has put itself in a bit of a position here. Let me say reputation, because their strategy of, you know, throughout the last couple of years has been to warn, yes, this is very bad, and they won't be able to, you know, fund agriculture. Once again, you know, assuming this is all about agriculture, but you know. But then when the issue of mortgages and bonds arose, they were very clear. No, you know, they expect to be paid. And I think that their submission to the government on this, that their bottom line is they want to be guaranteed that their interests are protected. And since the government probably won't give them that guarantee, you know, on its own dime, it sort of said, well, you know, then you must make the expropriated party pay. I think, you know, if ever you want to see the hammer and sickle flying over the, you know, First National and Standard buildings, you know, let them do that, because you will have a proletarian revolution led from Parkhurst and Blair Gowrie, not from you see what I mean. But you see, this is also a problem about political economy, that we have businesses that are deeply sort of connected to the state through the, you know, regulatory control, and they're not willing to sort of stand up and defend their clients.
Mm.
We as the institute actually went and confronted a number of banks and said, you know. And, you know, it was all very mealy-mouthed. Well, they kind of, they need, it's all about the, we want to be, make sure that we are sustainable. We love our clients so much, and we're going to be engaging in this process. But we couldn't get any of, I don't think we could get any of them to actually say, yes, we will actually go out to bat for our members.
Mm.
Interestingly, very similar with many of the agricultural institutions, you know, who would sort of sometimes talk a game about, well, you know, maybe we can do land reform at the lower end, but leave the big players alone. Or as one equipment dealer or vendor told us, I sell tractors to private farmers. Maybe in the future I have to sell them to the government.
Mm. Mm.
But you know, it's. The assumption is always that it's going to be someone else's problem.
Mm.
And as long as we can make it someone else's problem, we're okay. But remember, that crocodile will get angry.
Yeah. Well, I think that is a very good note to end on. The crocodile will get hungry. The act needs to be changed. It needs to be made constitutional. And I see that the DA has now said it is It is challenging, the act. I think the poor old DA is sort of trying to come up from behind on the messaging on this. A quick word before we end on that.
Yeah, look, I think that this is actually something you might want to have me back for at some point. How exactly does a coalition function in this in these circumstances, particularly when these issues become existential for their supporters?
Mm. Yeah.
And here's a point. For a coalition to work, you need to deliver cumulative wins to the country, but also individuated wins to the to the parties.
Mm.
And I don't think that the ANC is willing to concede those wins to their nominal parties, which makes me concerned about the viability of this arrangement long term, which I think would be a great tragedy for the country.
The series will be called Tsar Wars. Terence, thanks very much, and we will have you back soon.
Always a pleasure, Sarah. Thank you very much, and apologies for the delay.